Come in, come in, and welcome to the Eco Chamber. This is a podcast brought to you by the Journalist Events Report, exploring the most important environmental policies in the UK, with me, your host, James Ajapong Parsons. In this week's episode, we'll be talking about the lack of trust between DEFRA and the post-Brexit Green watchdog, according to an exclusive interview with a former DEFRA minister. The search for the missing land use framework. Where is it? We'll find out. And wet wipes, game birds, and wind turbines will hit you with a new News in Brief. For our deep dive, we'll be trying to unearth the truth about why the energy from waste sector has been put on ice after DEFRA gave the sector a red card on granting environmental permits. And yes, there's more to tell you about the Environment Secretary's involvement in the situation. So let's get ready as we explore this week's Eco Chamber! To help me on my expedition into the cave of big green news this week, I'm joined by Ends Report's features editor, Tess Colley. So for our first story, we're getting some exclusive insights into the thoughts of ex-DEFRA Minister Trudy Harrison, who has never been one to mince her words, even if they've sounded a little bit strange in the past. She left her post in November last year, but has a lot to get off her chest. Tess, you bagged this interview with Trudy. What did she have to say?
Well, yeah, she had a lot to say. I spent about an hour and a half with her in her office in Parliament, which I wasn't expecting to have that much time, but it was fantastic. One of the big things she told me was that there's this big lack of trust, she said, that sits between DEFRA and the Office for Environmental Protection, the post-Brexit Green watchdog. And that, you know, might not seem like a massive crazy issue when you're, you know, first hearing it, because, you know, the OEP is a watchdog set up to hold the government to account. You don't expect them to be great friends. You wouldn't want them to be pally.
Yeah.
But what was interesting was what she said was this lack of trust. She said this strain was meaning that DEFRA was withholding some information from the watchdog on how it intends to deliver on commitments made in its 2023 environmental improvement plan. And this is interesting because the watchdog has previously, you know, criticised and warned the government that its current goals are way off track and that it hasn't matched how it's going to make its policy commitments and its promises in that plan into a reality. And it hasn't shown its workings. But apparently this information does exist, if you believe Harrison. She told me it did, that she worked at that spreadsheet, but they haven't shared this information with the OEP because of this lack of trust. And when I pushed her on, like, where's this come from? She seemed to say, well, she sort of started talking about social media. And basically it seems like a fear of leaking is at the heart of it. I don't know how, you know, the OEP is a public body. I think sometimes information does come out from meetings that NGOs or other groups have with ministers. The OEP is a public body, though, and it's meant to be there to scrutinise the government. So I would have thought they'd be held in a different regard. So it was very interesting to hear her say that.
Not to infantilise DEFRA or Trudy Harrison here, but if DEFRA is the child and the OEP is the teacher, she's like saying, I have done the homework, but you can't check it, which I think is crazy. What has the OEP said in response to Harrison's, you know, claims of doing her homework?
Yeah, well, they said that they repeated, really, that they've been very clear in their reporting on the government's progress against its environmental improvement plan about the need for, and they said, robust delivery plans to show how it intends to meet its ambitions. Dame Glenys Stacey, she added that this transparency is also important for all those who have a role in holding government to account, including Parliament. And then she said, we work actively, professionally and constructively with colleagues in DEFRA to support them to fulfil their duty to cooperate with us as we fulfil our role. So, you know, she's saying they do work with DEFRA, is what she's saying. But also it is important that everyone is transparent, by the way, also.
Nudge, push, give us those answers. Okay, so Harrison now no longer in DEFRA.
Mm.
So what's DEFRA's official line?
Funnily enough, DEFRA's position isn't the same as its former minister. A DEFRA spokesperson said, we are fully committed to working constructively with the OEP to deliver for our environment, and we regularly engage with them at all levels on a variety of issues.
Not according to Trudy Harrison. And I did find it fascinating. She said some really interesting things in your interview with her. And I'd love to move on to this rebuttal to DEFRA's, this what used to be called DEFRA's culture of delay. That is this seemingly consistent delay or rollbacks on implementing policies. Can you just explain to us or talk to us a little bit about that?
Yeah, she was really interesting on that. And she was very keen to talk about it. I thought I'd have to push her a bit to, you know, why is DEFRA so chronically delayed on so many policies? But no, she wanted to talk about it. So basically, she recognised that the DEFRA group, so that's the civil service department and its regulators, have a brilliant science base, was her phrase. But in her view, the department lacks project delivery skills, and that is a problem because the department is being asked to deliver lots of complex projects. And so she sort of talked about how she, you know, she's got a background in project management, and coming from the Department for Transport, which is where she was transport minister prior to DEFRA, she was used to hearing things about Gantt charts, and she worked with organisations, she said, like National Rail and National Highways England, and she was used to language around tracking milestones, deliverables, interoperables, she said. But in DEFRA, that wasn't a language that was spoken. And that's she, in her view, and she kept coming back to this, so she definitely, this is something she really believes, is that that is the reason why so much doesn't get out. It's because it's the project delivery aspect that she says the skills aren't there.
Am I right in thinking that Trudy Harrison was one of those MPs looking to curtail the powers of Natural England?
Funnily enough, she is. She is now. She has put her name to what was quite a controversial private members bill, which has been tabled. The bill is arguing that a Natural England's powers to designate protected sites should be taken off it and given to the Secretary of State. She is backing it. But when she was actually Nature Minister, basically a year ago, last April, she defended Natural England in Select Committee, saying, you know, the real problem with Natural England is it's, you know, it's resourcing, it's kind of at risk of being spread too thin, suggesting that if you resourced it better, it would do its jobs a bit better. But she's now backing this bill to remove its powers. And she says it's because of what she's seen gone on in Dartmoor, in the Dartmoor review, which we've covered a lot on the podcast here. But basically that was all about pressure on Natural England not to tell farmers to remove livestock from the hills and the backlash that happened from that.
So it was good timing when you met her then on that week.
It was. It had just been tabled. So it was all fresh. Again, she was very keen to talk about it.
So I'm going to play devil's advocate here. Harrison says Natural England's scope is too narrow and that's why we need the remit of the Environment Secretary to take command of this situation. I mean, she has a point, doesn't she?
Well, I think no public body is, you know, should not be looked at ever. You know, public money, everyone deserves some scrutiny. And it's true that the country's protected sites, SSSIs, are in a dire state. Some recent analysis by the Campaign for National Parks show that just 26% of SSSIs in England's parks are in, I mean, what's called favourable condition. We've done our own investigation on this documentary Wilderness, which showed that, you know, there's a big mismatch between the amount of money that's been poured into the farming grants that go with these sites and how they actually are in reality. But the thing about the idea of taking power away from Natural England because of how these stats look. But for many campaigners who would comment on this, they'd say that this is a bit of a cop-out to try and take Natural England's powers away, because what they really need is more funding to do their job better. It's not that they have too many powers. If anything, maybe you should give them more so they can actually act with more authority. And some would say even this idea of trying to take away their power is a political power grab. That was something put to me recently, because it's just an idea of centralising things. Because, of course, the Environment Secretary does have more powers than Natural England. Mm. But what some people would worry is that they wouldn't use those powers to therefore put it all into nature recovery.
Mm.
They'd be balancing all sorts. They'd be, in theory, balancing the needs of farming and all sorts of other needs. On paper, maybe that sounds good, but in reality, you've got, these are politicians who can be, who are much more open, perhaps, you could argue, to being lobbied and to external forces. Natural England's meant to just be the scientific body, makes decisions on protected sites in the interests of nature. That's their thing. They're scientists, they're ecologists. The question was, why would you want to take that kind of decision-making away from them? Trudy Harrison would say, she did say, well, you know, they need to think about things, not just nature. But that's the exact sort of phrase that gets people who care a lot about protected sites and the environment, gets them anxious.
And there is so much more that we could go into this. If you're an N subscriber, you can read more on these fascinating insights from Harrison. Tess has put a great compendium together of everything that was discussed in that interview. But before we move on, I'm curious to know, what's she like? Like, what was your take on her in that time that you had?
Well, she's very, very amenable. She's very chatty and she was funny and, you know, she gave me a lot of her time, which I appreciated. She is, by her own admission, she kind of described herself as a people pleaser who, again, quoting, does not dislike anybody in this world, which I thought was was interesting phrasing, as she's often kind of been known for in our reporting anyway. But yeah, I did, being a people pleaser was funny, and I kind of dwelt on that a bit afterwards, because of course a lot of what she said won't please a lot of people.
No.
And you know, who you're trying to please is obviously the question. But I thought it was, you know, we talked about all sorts, including about what she was like working with Therese Coffey, and she kind of contrasted herself to Therese Coffey, the former environment secretary, as, you know, Therese Coffey wouldn't, you know, take falls gladly, and whereas she's a people pleaser, and that, she said, made them a good team. What I will say for Trudy Harrison is that she's very across the details of what was her brief. Sometimes I think she's maybe got a bad write-up sometimes, as not being totally across all the finer details. But talking to her, she, whether or not you agree with her, I think she knew what she was talking about from her point of view. You know, I thought that was something. But yeah, be interesting to see what she does next.
On to our second story of the week, and we're covering the latest update with the land use framework. Yes, it's still alive, folks, even though it's not been born. Tess, can you give our listeners a reminder about this unicorn policy?
Yes, so back in the days of 2022, in the National Food Strategy, the government kind of committed to publish this land use framework the following year, so 2023. As you may have noticed, it's 2024. And
I have noticed.
That's, yes.
Tick.
Tick.
I know that.
Oh, we're so good. But there's no land use framework, James. And the idea of it was to provide a sort of skeleton blueprint to help manage the increasing demands on UK land. And so it's quite a big idea, really. Idea we've got,
huge.
You know, you've got food production, you've got obviously nature and the needs of nature and the need for renewable energy and new housing. We've got all these really important competing demands, and we've only got our little island. What do you do about that? And this, you know, the idea behind it was you'd have this framework that would kind of sort it out, or at least strategically think about it. And there was quite a lot of excitement about it when it was first mooted, and that maybe DEFRA were thinking quite big with it. But I've heard since, and I think there's quite a lot of expectation management going on from the department. But it's much more likely to be very light touch framework, more guidance than something that's actually going to say, okay, well, no, this goes here and that goes there. The government don't want anything to do with telling landowners what to do with their land, basically. Mm. So at the moment, it's going to be kind of coming out at the, well, before the summer recess is the latest deadline. But deadlines, what do they mean? It's 2024. There's no land use framework.
It was touted as something really special, and I know campaigners love the idea. That does sound a little counterintuitive to me. There was a lot of hope and expectation put on that policy at the time, at least the idea of it. You were at an event recently. How did government officials downplay or explain it now?
So I went to this land use summit hosted by the Zoological Society for London and the British Ecological Society recently, and they had some like top civil service brass from DEFRA and Department for Energy and Department for Housing there. They were at great lengths to emphasise that it won't see landowners talk to with their land. So Lucy Smith, who's the Director General of Strategy and Change at DEFRA, what she said was, "The land use framework will help us with policy making," she said. "It's about providing a long-term perspective on England's land use and the government's approach to delivering our objectives." And she said, you know, it's not a framework that's going to be a model. It's not going to tell land managers what to do. I know that's a repetition, but it was repeated multiple times.
We get it, Lucy. Yeah. We get it.
Not just by her, by the others, the other kind of people there. The idea is that it helps, she said, it helps us solve that problem. And that problem she was talking about was government departments working in silos on different land use issues. And that's what I understand from a few chats I've had, is that the reason there's been this big hold up with it is kind of that fact that the silos and we're actually getting the different departments to work together in a proper way, in a way that's going to actually create anything everyone can agree on these big issues, has been tough. And it's only quite recently that they've actually maybe started working together a bit more effectively. And that's my understanding. And I also understand that Steve Barclay, so the Environment Secretary, has taken the reins from the DEFRA perspective, where it was previously was sort of within the portfolio of his ministers. So that suggests it's being taken up a level a bit to get that top level coordination going on.
I did find it interesting that there were some quite big admissions from each of the different civil servants in the departments at your event. Can you just take us through some of those?
Yeah, I mean, I guess they probably wouldn't see them as admissions, probably because they're working on it all the time. But it was interesting to hear, for example, the kind of head of energy infrastructure planning from the Department for Energy talking about, I mean, basically he was kind of throwing the gauntlet down, might be too strong a phrase, but he was saying, look, we need renewables. They don't actually take up that, they're not set to take up that much land as a percentage, but like there's no green transition that you don't notice, is what he was saying, is that we are going to see it and it's going to have to be in someone's backyard. And it's probably not anything that, you know, that you don't know if you think about it for half a second. But the fact that he had turned up and he made the point and he stayed at the summit for a good few hours, which not all of the civil servants who came, including some from DEFRA, left quite quick after they'd said their piece.
They saw you, Tess, and they were like, nope, don't want to take any questions.
I was hiding out, just, you know.
I mean, on that point, it is interesting because, you know, the debates around solar farms in the countryside, there it is an issue. Yeah. And there will be.
It is an issue. Nobody wants it. And, it, you know, no one wants a wind turbine in their backyard. No one wants a solar farm. So what happens there? It does have to go somewhere. That's the end of it. And nature recovery is really important. And of course, you know, we talk about this all the time. We know it is. But there, you know, something will have to give somewhere. There was a really interesting presentation that essentially raised the question of, you know, we could save every species in the UK and really push everything in. We could maybe, you know, you export all of your energy or blah, 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 and you improve all of England's nature, but you absolutely screw over all that, you know, you screw over nature somewhere else in the globe. And of course, this, like, we talk about kind of the UK a lot, but of course, it's a global issue.
Cool.
And so basically, kind of, you know, if you lose some rooks somewhere in England or some other species, is it worth it to save a whole load of other species somewhere else in a different country? Open question. It's a bit uncomfortable really to pose it, because, you know, no one wants to say, yeah, you know, we know what, those ones we might have to lose them. But we are facing, it is a crisis. It's not going to, and that's it. But it's quite confronting, some of it, especially some of the stats around, it was kind of, you know, some of the things that were presented at that conference were quite confronting, especially around how we manage food going into the future.
I thought we'd do something a little bit different to end the big green news this week. And that is a quickfire news cycle. It's been super busy this week, and that's just on environmental policy. So I'm going to start. Then you test than me, if that's cool. First up for me, it's news that DEFRA licenses for game bird releases in protected areas were unlawful. Go figure. Now, for those not in the know, there was a countrywide outbreak of bird flu last year, And at the time, between July and October 2023, the former Environment Secretary Therese Coffey and the DEFRA Minister Lord Richard Benyon licensed the release of pheasants and red-legged partridges near the Deben Estuary in Suffolk and the Breckland in Norfolk, both of which are SPAs, Special Protection Areas. We now know this went against Natural England's advice, which is fine, but if the department does not follow the watchdog's advice, it is legally required to show the reasons why. We now know, thanks to Wild Justice, that neither Coffey nor Benyon did, which raises that age-old problem of the closeness of the shooting fraternity to DEFRA. And of course, it has stepped into the realms of unlawfulness. That's my news in brief.
Okay, well, from DEFRA to the Department for Energy Security and Net Zero, the news there is that Energy Secretary Claire Coutinho last week overruled Seabird concerns to approve two offshore wind farm extensions. So, Equinor New Energy submitted plans to build up to 53 wind turbines off the coast of Norfolk at the existing Sheringham Shoal offshore wind farm extension project.
Well done.
Say that fast.
Well done.
And Dungeon Offshore Wind Farm Extension Project. She did it twice. Coutinho has been resolute in this decision, as we now know she's overruled her planning inspectors, who warned that approving these expansion projects would be in breach of the Habitats Regulations and the UK's international obligations under the Ramsar Convention. In particular, the examining panel had warned that the compensation package, as proposed for Sandwich Terns and Guillemots, is insufficiently developed and unproven. But Coutinho disagreed and has given it her seal of approval.
I look forward to seeing who takes on that legal challenge. And finally, it's news that legislation to ban plastic wet wipes in England will be introduced to Parliament in the next 2 months. Yes, that's according to the Environment Secretary Steve Barclay. Now, ministers in Scotland and Wales have confirmed their intention is to bring in legislation by the end of this year, with a ban to come into force by June 2026. Fact, a UK-wide ban on wet wipes containing plastics was first mooted in 2018. It's 2024. And that is our news in brief. It's time now for our moment of the week, and it's all about the Environment Act. ENDS Report has published an exclusive documentary featuring former Environment Secretary George Eustace, former Minister Zach Goldsmith, the chair of the OEP, Dame Glenys Stacey. We've got EACC chair, Philip Dunn. We've got, who else? We've got Richard Benwell from the WCL. And we've also got Ruth Chambers, who is lovely people, let me tell you. It's a wonderful creation, looking back at how the Environment Act, this seminal piece of legislation, came into being, what its architects, those in the know, were trying to do at the time, what worked, what failed, what they got, what they didn't get. And all the pressures around it, there was a lot going on during that time. You had the post-Brexit era, you had COVID, a lot was at stake. So I highly recommend it. If you are an ENDS subscriber, you can watch it now, Legacy. endsreport.com/legacy. Don't miss out. Time now for our deep dive as I get down and dirty with the editor of ENDS Waste and Bioenergy, Luke Walsh. Luke also hosts the Burning Issue podcast, interviewing leading figures in the energy recovery sector, aiming to investigate where the sector is now and where it goes from here. So who better to speak to in my quest to get to the bottom of what's really been going on in the energy from waste sector after DEFRA gave it a timeout on granting new environmental permits? DEFRA's decision to temporarily pause these new permits issued by the EA is a big deal. What's as intriguing is the closeness of the Environment Secretary Steve Barclay and his opposition to an energy from waste plant in his own backyard. Now, Luke, a big preamble there from me. So can you just start by reminding our listeners how and why the government has paused granting these permits for energy from waste plants?
Yeah. Well, hi, James. Thanks again for having me on the Eco Chamber. It's always a pleasure. We both started off in local newspaper journalism, and this whole thing reminds me of covering local councils. In my view, the permit pause, it all links back to the EFW project you mentioned. It's led by MVV in Medworth, where Secretary of State for DEFRA, Steve Barclay's constituency, is in Cambridge. Basically, another department base signed off that plant through the planning consent, through a development consent order. That was signed off by, it turned out to be Lord Callaghan, which we understand that Steve Barclay's department raised an issue with, which led to a pause in that consent being official, while Claire Coutinho decided whether she should have had the official say. That was all established as fine, and it went through. Steve Barclay then is still supposed to have been displeased and has questioned it further. And now we've got this situation where there's a permit pause for 7 weeks for plants, which interestingly takes us beyond the local elections, which you could say is perhaps helping them locally.
I mean, and we should stress that we're not arguing over whether planning permission has been granted. Like you say, they've got planning permission.
That's fine.
It's the issue to do with the environmental permits, which they can't get signed off and start development until Steve Barclay's department gives it them.
Yeah, it was granted a draft permit in January, and usually it takes a few weeks, a couple of months for that draft to be made permanent. It's normally a rubber stamping exercise, the environmental permitting thing. As long as a proper company has gone through a permitting thing, they should get it.
Right.
But this one is now held up. So,
I mean, we should talk about timing here, because there is an issue to do with, as I understand it, correct me if I'm wrong, when Steve Barclay got involved with all of this controversy with the Wisebeck incinerator and the moratorium, the temporary moratorium on environmental permits being issued. Can you just take us through some of that?
The rumour is that after Steve Barclay raised issues over whether the DCO was fairly sorted, that someone in base department then contacted DEFRA to say that Steve Barclay hadn't formally recused himself from the environmental permitting process, which he then did, I think around, it was late February, wasn't it? Don't quote me on the dates, but that it was after all of the initial kickoff. And well, he's always said all along, he's shown that he's opposed to it. He didn't formally sign the documents, which he should have done. Now it's all being dealt with by Mark Spencer, his junior there, but it doesn't come across well, does it?
And I know it doesn't. And I read that on the same day that he formally recused himself, another of his junior ministers,
Robbie Moore,
thank you, then went to the EA's chief to ask for his understanding, or gave him a 24-hour period to get his understanding of what it would mean for the EA and the EFW sector should this moratorium go through, which was actually going to be much longer than the one
they wanted a year originally. It's not explained in the letters why the year was changed down, but I imagine they must have been told that there was legal problems with that. But it's interesting that it's come from Robbie Moore as well, because his constituency in Keighley, there's another energy from waste plant by Endless Energy, which does have a permit and does have planning consent, but is a big issue locally. And he got his seat campaigning against the plant, and now Labour are again campaigning against that plant there. So both Barclay and Moore have local issues that have concerned them with energy from waste plants, and they can show that they are fighting against them through this. But are they really splitting their constituency and secretary and ministerial roles?
Can I ask you then, for those not in the know, and I appreciate every energy from waste plant is different, but what are the main oppositions to them? Like, let's take Wisebeck. Am I saying it right, Wisebeck?
I think it's Wisebeck.
Wisebeck, thank you. This is why we have experts on the show. Wisebeck. Can you just take us through what some of the objections are, like why so strong?
I think particularly Barclay in particular referred to lorry movements. I think there's about 300 back and forth, and that it was close to a school. But my mum actually lives not far from the area, so I've been to the site because I'm that fun. And it's quite industrial. Although there is the school at one end, it's basically an industrial site, and a lot of the other sites are facing compulsory purchase orders because they're going to be made way for the plant. So they're a bit worried. But it's, you know, Wisebeck itself is a nice town. It's got an industrial aspect to it, and that whole part was tackled by the planning thing. It's not really the environment permits thing to look at the planning and the capacity and the location, is it?
Right. So chiefly then, it comes down to would you say? Is there a general trend of lorry movements and local opposition?
One of the better run energy from waste plants is Cory in southeast London, and they move a lot of their waste by river, and that's always been their thing. So there's quite a few other plants move some by rail. That I, from a planning point of view, those are always key factors that will help push a application through.
Right.
But in the more rural place, the east of England, Cambridgeshire, there isn't that infrastructure. I mean, some people have talked about maybe moving things in canals and stuff, but it's tricky. It's too, other people say it's too small.
Okay.
Realistically, the waste has to be moved by trucks. If people are going to put black bag waste outside their house, it's got to be collected by a trucks and it's got to be taken somewhere.
Right.
And an energy from waste plant is better than a landfill.
Do we know the scale of the plant in Barclays constituency?
Yeah. It can take up to, well, its permitted capacity that they want to get is just over 650,000 tonnes a year. So it does put it in the larger side of it. It's bigger than, well, Cory together will have just over 1 million tonnes. Runcorn is permitted to do 1 million tonnes, but does just under that. So it's not the biggest plant. It's smaller than some of the ones in the Netherlands and things, but it's one of the larger facilities. So it's going to be controversial.
Well, I mean, it's good to get a sense of scale with all this stuff. And it's one of the 10 energy from waste plants that we understand currently sort of caught up in this environmental permit moratorium.
It's very hard to work out what the other 10 are. I've asked the Environment Agency, they won't say. There's no record of people who are applying for permits. So there's ones, you know, that there's one in Boston that's 1 million tonnes. So, but by adding up generally what you can tell by, I think there must be close to 3 million tonnes trapped in just those 10 projects. So it's a lot. There's a lot of capacity that is going to get jittery at the moment.
Okay, then on jitters, what have your sources been saying about this issue and what the government's up to at the minute?
Well, they're all annoyed, I think, is the word that you could use. You can't
politely
use the word.
Annoyed.
Yeah, you can't use the words that they've been saying. It's like political theatre, shambles, all those sort of phrases I've heard. People don't really understand why it's happened. Is it maybe to boost the local elections? Is it heading into a general election? There doesn't seem to be any real reason behind it. Is it maybe an indication of how the government sees this later on? Because obviously DEFRA is bringing out some work on incinerator capacity. I don't know.
So that's the official line, isn't it? They've said that this time we'll let them give them lead a piece of work considering the role of waste incineration in the management of residual waste in England. So that doesn't really hold true, your sources think.
No, not 7 weeks. What difference does the 7 weeks make? That's what everyone's saying. It just seems convenient for the current portfolio holders and how it's worked out for them.
So one of the things that I have been thinking about, and that is, Steve Barclay, as well as being Environment Secretary, he is an MP, okay? He represents his constituents and more as well. What's the problem with Barclay raising his objections? You know, he's an MP. What's the problem with that?
Well, as an MP, he's allowed to object to stuff in his constituency, but like as we've explained, he has to recuse himself from it. And it's the timing that which he did it. And obviously, he can't use his ministerial role to support his constituency role. And that this is what the opposition Labour Party, Steve Reid especially, has been calling for an investigation of this and to look into the exact timings. And I think the pressure seems to be mounting on Barclay. The BBC are doing lots of stories on it. It's not very often that you see energy from waste in the mainstream, apart from if it's a controversial planning decision going their way. So it could something might more come out of it. Stephen Reid doesn't sound like he's letting it go, does he?
No, so. No. And I saw any chance to take a sort of a pop shot at the Tories.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And actually, you mentioned the BBC. It's probably worth saying that they did put a story up recently that a week before Barclay steps aside, he actually asked for legal advice on whether or not a Secretary of State or Minister could pause an incinerator permit. Sources at the BBC say.
The BBC have run this story. MVV haven't officially commented, but the word is that they're looking to sue if it gets held up for any longer and the legal action could follow. I mean, they won't officially say that. But...
No, you heard it here first, though, listeners. It was really interesting to hear about more. Have there been any other Conservative MPs who have sort of taken advantage of this or used this as a chance to, I don't know, push their own interests in this field?
Yes, yeah. Like I said, with Moore's constituency in Keighley, the Labour candidate has pushed for an expansion of the thing to cover plants that have permits and planning consent. And another Conservative MP for Horsham, Jeremy Quinn, has also come out and talked about a project that's called the Share Facility in his constituency. He says that should be blocked because it's stalled. I spoke to the developer about it and they said it is developing. They've done the initial groundworks. The planning consent is enacted. It's valid. The trouble is with energy from waste plants now, they used to be signed with a deal with a local authority and they could be built. Local authority contracts are golden. It's straightforward. Now all the deals are for commercial and industrial waste. So that's a bit harder to get the finances in place for. So it takes longer. So these projects appear to be dragging, but they're still developing along. Quinn's obviously, like Barclay, they're all facing an election this year. It's a good point. I asked him about it when I spoke to the developers and they said his comments were stupid. He doubled down on it and said, he thinks they're looking at them. We should carry on. We should maybe expand the pause. So fair enough.
You're right, you're wrong. No. So where does the industry go from here? Do they wait for a new government? Do they, hold fast to the Conservatives? Do you have a sense of where the industry's at?
It's interesting, isn't it? I think, there's still, the latest government records, there's still 13 odd million tonnes going to landfill. There's still 1.5 million tonnes being exported. So are we up to capacity on energy from waste? I'd say no, we're not. Even if waste goes down, it's going down fractionally in production terms, isn't it? So we need to do something with it. But if the government isn't going to put the support policies there, no one's going to build these plants. So we might, maybe we'll come back and talk about 5 years' time about another crunch of energy from waste plants being built because we missed out before. But they're going to cost more and it's going to take more waste to landfill in the meantime.
So is the current sentiment that we don't need any more energy from waste in policy circles at government level?
At some government level, I think that attitude has caught on. And I think that's an attitude that's been led by some NGOs. I think in fairness to UK Wind, the UK Without Incineration, they know their stuff and they're against energy from waste, but they're a good body. But there's a lot of people out there who've watched some YouTube videos and run a composting heap and think they can do all the waste management and they can't. And I speak to people who do it and they say that we need more capacity, especially in regions like the east of England, especially in the southeast, to a lesser degree in the southwest, and still arguably in Wales, where they've got a moratorium. Wales sends waste to England for energy recovery, so it's not self-sufficient, is it? There's still capacity needed.
Do you or some of your industry contacts think that Labour will change that direction?
Yeah, I think there is concern about that. People have always looked at Sadiq Khan, of how a Labour government could act. And Sadiq Khan was quite firm in coming down with no more energy capacity in London. He initially tried to challenge Cory when they were building a second plant, but didn't have the funds to funding the judicial review, so didn't go forward. It's always been seen pretty much the Conservative government leaves business to decide what it wants to do, and a Labour government might be more interested. It's difficult to predict because, there will be a general election this year or by January at the latest, isn't it? January next year. But whether they're going to be focused quickly on waste compared to how many other disasters the country's got going on, I don't know.
And that's it. We've come to the end of this week's Eco Chamber. My thanks to Tess Colley and Luke Walsh for exploring this week's episode, helping me and I hope you get to grips with the biggest issues of the week and why energy from waste has become a political hot potato. We'd love to hear from you listeners with your thoughts, your views and opinions. You can reach us by emailing ecochamber@haymarket.com or on our socials using the hashtag ecochamber. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast and maybe even share it with a friend. Until the next time, take care.